Thank you, Bob. Good to be back. Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me back. I'm really honored, and I must tell you how much this group means to me. You give me courage and encouragement and hope. Yeah, so thank you. Thanks, Tom. And I do like the new tagline. I think it really does speak to what I've experienced from you. And one of the things I really appreciate, and it's exemplified in this book, is that you're courageous enough to look at the real issues that people are talking about and struggling with and the questions they're asking. And I think the attendance at a topic like this speaks so clearly to it. Okay? I'd like to begin with a story which fits the topic today. Many years ago, when I was training to be a spiritual director and learning the art of spiritual direction, I went to Pecos Benedictine Monastery in New Mexico. And the administrators of the program invited us to choose or select a prayer partner amongst the attendees. And so Wendy and I kind of chose each other. There was this one particular morning talk that I'll never forget when Wendy and I were seated next to each other listening to this woman named Samantha share her story. She started her story off this way. When I was 4 years old, my father was killed tragically in a car accident. Then I told God that since he took my daddy, he had to be my daddy. And so every morning, I'd wake up and I would imagine God holding my hand or walking with me or playing with me or talking with me. I did that through all my life. I didn't realize what a good practice that was until people commented upon how healthy I seemed to be. How in the world did I make this adjustment? And that I chose a wonderful man to be my husband. And she went on and on speaking about that. About halfway through her story, Wendy starts to cry and doesn't stop until the end of her whole story. So finally I turned to her, because I didn't want to interrupt what was going on. I said, Wendy, what's the matter? She said, that's my story, but I did the opposite. When I was 4, my father died from cancer. But because he was gone, I started looking for other men to fill the vacuum. And it got me into a lot of trouble, a lot of needless pain. She says, thank God, my husband's a wonderful man. But I cause a lot of pain and suffering in myself and in others. This is an extremely important lesson for all of us. Along with our scientific advancements, we have to balance them with an immersion in embracing of and celebrating the human imagination in dynamic and creative ways. So let me summarize it for you in one sentence. Because we are not willing to mythologize, we tend to pathologize. Or to unpack that in more popular language, because we're not willing to truly tell the authentic stories of our pain as human beings, they tend to become repressed, undiagnosed, unacknowledged, and they come out, are you ready for this? In our bodies and our souls. And this is why we're here this morning. Because we've all experienced what happens when we choose not to let go. In God's great wisdom, God has given every single lesson we need for life hidden in our body. It is the great and wonderful earthiness of our body that will keep us honest if we're willing to pay attention. And this is why we guard that. As Christian believers, we say, as St. Paul said, our bodies are the temple of God's presence. And there's a lot of wonderful significance in what that means. So, how we tell our stories is a lot more about who we are than about the story itself. Most of us have been more influenced by the medical and the legal professions about how we tell our stories. And so often we think, just tell me the facts, ma'am. Nothing but the facts. Who, what, when, where, and why. Would you agree? But there's another way to tell the story of your life. And that's what Desmond Tutu is talking about. To tell the story from the perspective of your soul. That is so important. And as believers, we know that intuitively, but we often forget it. Because that's why Jesus' parables were so transformative. He told the story from the perspective of the human soul. Not what's right, what's wrong, how many times does this take place. On the contrary, it's a whole different perspective. And its effects have a different response. So listen to James Hillman in his book, Healing Fiction, as he says, the way we imagine our lives The way we tell our stories is the way we're going to go on living our lives. For the manner in which we tell ourselves about what is going on is the genre through which events become experiences. There are no bare events, plain facts, simple data. Or rather, this too is an archetypal fantasy, the simplistic, a brute, or dead nature. And so he goes on to say, outside and inside, life and soul appear as parallels in case history and soul history. A case history is a biography of historical events in which one took part: family, school, work, illness, war, love. The soul history often neglects entirely some or many of these events and spontaneously invents fictions and inscapes without major outer correlations. The biography of the soul concerns experience. It seems not to follow the one-way direction of the flow of time, and it's reported best by emotions, dreams, and fantasies. The experiences arising from major dreams, crises, and insights give definition to the personality. As I'll point out later, the very areas that we kind of poo-poo and say, you know, we don't talk about that stuff anymore because we are an educated people, you know? And since the age of rationalism, the very things that we've ignored and marginalized are the very things that can and will and do wake us up if we're paying attention. So in this particular chapter, Desmond Tutu invites us and his co-author to look at something that can liberate us. But if we approach it with this case history mentality, just the facts and no more, or, by God, I need to get over this like a cold, then we will not experience authentic healing. And it begins to pile up. Let me give you an analogy from an acquaintance of mine. He was in a serious car accident, had what is called a side whiplash. You all know what that is? Okay. Now, believe it or not, he was in a Volvo, so he's very well protected. But it was such a powerful accident, he was T-boned, that literally his whole body went to the side. He went to the typical things, therapy, etc. And it was not working. Then someone said to him, have you ever heard of a cranial manipulator? He said, no, what's that? Well, it's somebody who's trained in the art of manipulating the different plates of the skull in such a way they get realigned. He says, that sounds kind of hokey. He says, no, this woman is a high intuitive, she's well trained, and she comes at healing from a different perspective. What have you got to lose? He said, all right. So he went. He sat down in the chair. The woman begins to talk to him. She just lays her hands on his head. And she just begins to move just a little bit. And then after about 2 minutes, she very simply said, what happened to you when you were 2 years of age? He was stunned. Immediately, as she said the question, what came to mind as she's manipulating the skull plates, when I was two, I'll never forget it, I was in the kitchen, I had a bowl of Cheerios. And being a two-year-old, I was sloppy, I wasn't paying attention, and I accidentally tripped and I spilled the whole bowl of Cheerios. I have no idea what was happening in my father's life, but I never forget that he screamed at me, raged at me, called me names, and he kicked me. To this day, he denies it ever took place. I said, okay. And she worked a little bit more in silence. What happened to you when you were in 10? He talked about a memorable bike accident that left him incapacitated for a while. And then up to 15, and that was enough for the day. He said, okay. He said, tell me what's going on. She said, well, your skeletal system is like a stack of cards. That your body has an ability to absorb lots and lots of pain or lots and lots of trauma. But eventually, the body says, enough, and it starts to break down. What's happened is this car accident is your breaking down, and that's why you're here. And I know this probably seems, because you're a well-educated man, this seems like hokey stuff, but I'm just listening to your body. I didn't know what happened at 2 and 10 and 15, but your body knows. Your body stored all that up. And until you're willing, here's a key line, you're willing to release the trauma, to see it in the bigger picture, it's going to stay locked in your body, waiting for it to be acknowledged. That's soul history. You see? You're getting a feel for it? Okay? Case history would be, well, you know, when I was 2, my dad yelled at me. When I was 10, I had a bike accident. When I was 15, There's something deeper there. And this is what Desmond and his co-author point out are called explicit and implicit memories. The explicit memory is the conscious memory. You know what happened. When, where you were at, the time, the place, the location, maybe remembering colors, etc. Who was involved in it. But the implicit memory is something deeper. We might call from the subconscious experience of your life. Or a more intuitive experience. So that whenever you get near to a similar scene, or you get near to that person, or that time of day, depending upon what the trauma is, you can almost feel something's different. But you say, oh, I'm just imagining it. There's that word. It's not real. Okay? Or, as one woman experienced, every single February 2nd, she would get suicidal ideation. And it would last for about 3 days. And she could not explain it. Her therapist couldn't explain it. It was only in the beginning of February. What in the world is going on? She was an African-American woman. And she decided at the inspiration and invitation, a friend of hers said, why don't you look up your family history? Is it possible there's something in your family lineage that maybe you don't know? Maybe someone else took their life in your family line. She says, oh no, my mother would have told me that. Well, why don't you just check it? So finally, after a while, she decided to do that. And what she found out was something fascinating. It was back about, I think it was 3 or 4 generations. There were 2 different women in her family who had taken their life on the exact same day, February 2nd. The first person was a slave on the ship coming from West Africa. And her daughter did the same thing, February 2nd. So something deep in her soul, this is what we call implicit memory, was activated at a deep subconscious level, inviting her to wake up to it. Not inviting her to take her life, but to honor what was going on. And once she faced it, she told the story, she expressed in the ways I'm going to share with you, she was liberated. So that day now became a time for her, as we do, it's a pray for the deceased. That became for her like November 2nd. She would pray for these 2 women in her lineage. So I love this line that Desmond uses. It is not the trauma that defines us, but the meaning that we make of the experience that defines who we are and who we are ultimately going to become. That's a powerful line. In effect, he's summarizing the whole school of logotherapy. Viktor Frankl, during World War II, because of his experience, developed this whole concept that we can live with meaning through any trauma if we're willing to face it and to delve into the depths of it. If not, it can take our life. This was based on a study that he had intimately involved where the concentration camp where he was sequestered is that he noticed one particular year, 1943, that for about a period of 6 months, nobody in the camp died. Not a single person. He said it was phenomenal because the conditions were atrocious, but not a single person died. And then he discovered why. There was a rumor going around that the Allies were going to liberate them by Christmas of this year. Listen to what happened. As you know, it didn't happen by Christmas of 43. The day after Christmas, people started dying like flies. Nothing changed. The diet, the condition, nothing changed. But they lost their meaning. You see? And it's one of those things that he found so helpful in his own life and those patients that he worked with that he wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, and then eventually developed the School of Logotherapy. So Desmond is echoing this great truth, that how do you define the trauma that's happened to you, or a family member, or somebody that you love or work with? Because what you define it for and by is going to give you a modicum of great happiness, peace, harmony, or deep sadness, or ongoing suffering. I appreciated Tutu's great statement, and I firmly believe this. We always have a choice of how to respond. This is what we hold in such great reverence, that human beings have a free will. Even when we've been deeply traumatized, violated in any way, we can choose how to respond. And the choice can become transformative, sharing in the resurrection, or it can become imprisoning. It can name you, over-identify you with that particular violent act, or that confrontation, or that traumatic illness. So, listen to this quote that I got from a woman who was victimized from the time that she was a little girl. It's a great quote. She said, "Victimization is an event. Being a victim is a choice." I got to tell you, this woman lives it. One more time. Victimization is an event. Being a victim is a choice. It's a stance towards life. So, telling our stories to an audience that knows how to listen, how to be present to us, is how we get our dignity back. I don't know if you realize this, but in the Christian tradition, the reason we listen to the Scriptures, and that's so much a part of our services and our worship gatherings, is so that the story may help to change the story of our lives as individuals and as a community. But so often we can over-spiritualize what we're listening to. We can sit or we can stand, we can even memorize it. But if we don't apply it, the liberating gift to our life, and we literalize it, we end up pathologizing our lives. We pick and we choose what we call the Scriptures of promise, the ones that we like, and the ones that are difficult, that we don't understand, we kind of toss aside. And isn't it odd that we tend to hold on to and literalize the ones that can be destructive in our life? Believe it or not, the authors of the Scriptures invited us to step into an imagination, God's imagination, to help us to imagine ourselves as being fully human, fully alive, to help us to even begin to imagine what it means to be divinized beings, living in the Spirit of the living God. But most of us, now we don't get it. The story told about Scott Peck, who was asked to speak to a Christian audience. He chose the Scripture of the woman who was struggling with the hemorrhage of so many years. And after he finished proclaiming it, he asked the audience, "Okay, how many of you identify with this woman?" It's about 35% that raised their hand. "How many of you identify with the apostles?" It's about another 20% that raised their hand. "And how many of you identify with the crowd that was all around them?" And the rest of the people raised their hand. He said, "How many of you identify with the person of Christ?" Not one person raised their hand. Let me ask it again. "How many of you identify with Jesus?" Not one person even changed their mind. "You know, I'm a bit confused. I was told it's a Christian audience. Is that true?" "Oh, yeah, yeah." "Oh, yes, doctor. Yes, we're all Christian." He says, "Well, in any religion, the founder or foundress, that's the master. For the mistress. This is the one we're supposed to truly follow the model. And you're saying that none of you are doing that." Well, they were stunned, upset, of course. But he said, "Jesus stands in the midst of this story, inviting this woman to receive a release. But a reverse flow, an inflow rather than outflow. And yet none of you can see it and identify it. None of you experience this in your life. Then I would dare say that you don't know the Jesus of the Scriptures." Ooh. But that's what we're talking about. Is that to be a follower of Christ means that we're not afraid of our story. That God enters the story of humanity to help us to see ourselves differently. To see ourselves as God sees us. Now, theologically, we call this the beatific vision. But practically, it means let God love you and celebrate that. Live as if you're already in eternity. Don't wait for the end of life. Most of us use the Scriptures to unlock keys of how can I have this exit strategy and get into heaven when I die. That's so silly and immature. The Scriptures are written for an immersionist strategy, how to live in this life alive and filled and vibrant with the Spirit. And so what Desmond is doing for us is taking one small part of the Christ story and showing us how we can do it. Knowing the full story is a predictor of health and happiness. What it does, it connects us to the larger story of the cosmos, the larger story of the Christ, what we call the cosmic Christ, the larger story of the human condition. This is why our story needs to be told. You know, sometimes I do this teasing, but I honestly mean it. When I'm hearing confession, very often I'm moved by the penitent. And I'll say, wow, what a powerful story. Have you shared this with anybody else? Oh, no, Father. For God's sake, they're my sins. Oh, but they're so beautiful. So imaginative, so creative, or so insightful. Why don't you talk to somebody about your struggle? You'll be surprised to discover that many people have that same struggle. Sometimes the best and the juiciest things that we can learn about our story are hidden in areas that are secretive, embarrassing, and shame-based. And that those can be the very areas that can liberate us. So Desmond goes on to say, to keep the secret pain of the story inside you without adequate expression imprisons you and makes you sick. I believe that. I've seen it happen too many times. Remember the story of Jesus and the paralyzed man? His four buddies bring Christ before him and he says, your sins are forgiven. And the audience is horrified by that. You know? And so he says, which is easier to say, okay, pick up your mat and go home. He points out exactly what Desmond is talking about here, is that when you're not willing to let the secret shame, the secret pain, the trauma, truly be told in a way that can be liberated, then it gets locked down your body and it literally calcifies you, embitters you, or imprisons you. So this is why we are invited to learn how to tell the story well and often, and to be trained as listeners, to be present to people who are sharing that pain. You can read a wonderful book by Alice Miller, a Swiss psychoanalyst, who wrote a book called The Body Never Lies. In her profession, as a professional listener, she found that she had, I believe it was either 9 or 10 clients that she had worked with for many years, and there was no change in the physical health of these particular clients. And then one day, this insight dawned on her, the one that Desmond just pointed out. And so she said, could you tell me the story of your bodily pain? And they would tell the story. And as they told the story, finally, from the perspective of the wound, they were healed, physically healed, which ended therapy. So let me tell you an example of this that happened recently. Dr. Peter Levine tells this story. There was a fireman who had been on call and responded to a fire. And after rescuing this woman from the second or third story, carrying her on his shoulder down, he developed what he called a frozen shoulder. And so he went to a doctor and could find nothing physically wrong of why his shoulder should be limited. So eventually he was referred to Dr. Levine, Peter Levine, who's a psychiatrist. And so first thing the fireman said to him is, doctor, I'm not crazy. I never said you were. He said, would you sit down and tell me the story of how your frozen shoulder happened? He said, let's start with how you think it happened. And he retold the story I just told you. It's okay. He says, now, would you tell me a story about anything memorable that happened, you know, a few days before that or a few days after? He said, yes, I remember. He said, I was off duty and I was driving home when I came to an intersection where a car accident had just happened. This SUV had been T-boned and knocked on its side, and there was fuel from the fuel tank spilling out. The engine was still running. The driver was unconscious. So I jumped out of my vehicle, ran up, and as I reached inside to try and turn off the engine, I happened to notice across the driver's lap that there was a baby in the seat right next, and the child had been decapitated. Yeah. And Dr. Levine said, okay. He said, I'm going to invite you to enter an exercise. Do you think you can trust me in this? Sure. Okay. He said, would you please close your eyes? And he said, now I'd like you to picture that scene again. You're sitting inside your truck and you come up to the intersection, and he plays the whole scene for him. The guy's nodding his head. He said, okay, now walk up to the vehicle. You smell the fumes. You recognize it's pretty dangerous. You recognize you need to turn off the engine. You reach inside, and as you're reaching across, you see the baby. Look at the baby. Take a good look at the baby. Look at the head. See the baby. Recognize what you're feeling. All the jumbled feelings together. Fear, anxiety, terror. But make sure you keep going. Turn off the engine. Turn off the engine. Turn the key. Turn the key. Turn the key. Pull your arm out. Stand back. Away from the vehicle. And when you're ready, open your eyes. He said, okay, sir. He said, would you please stand? So the man stood. He said, could you take your arm and just reach up about this high? Can you do that? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's no problem. He said, try going a little bit higher. And as he raised it, his eyes got really big and wide. It's all the way, as high as you can. Can you reach the ceiling? Oh, yeah. How about out? Yep, behind you. He said, doc, what happened? He said, isn't it interesting we use that term frozen shoulder? Your shoulder wasn't frozen. What was happened was your emotions were frozen. Your emotions told your body to shut down because you weren't willing to listen to the emotions. They were too horrific for you because your training rode right over your feelings. And probably the reason why this happened to you is because, as you told me earlier, you have a child the same age as the child who was killed in the accident. So all of that kicked together and it froze you because it was saying, we're not going any further until you pay attention to this message. That you are a man not only trained, intellectually astute, but you are a sensitive man as well. So knowing the full story is a predictor of future and present health and happiness. I'm not going to ask you for a show of hands, but how many of you were told by your mother or father or auntie or favorite uncle or grandmother, grandfather, now this is a family secret, don't tell anybody. But I'm the last one that knows this, and I want to give it to at least somebody in the family. So don't raise your hands. But I'm willing to bet that there are many people here who have that. It happened to my brother. One of our brothers was told an awful secret. And I'll never forget the day he decided to tell it. He said, I can't do this anymore. And he shared it in the midst of all of our siblings, and it stunned one of my brothers. And it had to do with what happened to my mother and father and about the story of his conception. He was absolutely stunned. He didn't know what to do with it. So we, together, after the story had been let out, the secret, we gathered around him, we held him, we loved him, said, be that as it may, it doesn't change who you are. You're still loved. But it's time that you and Mom talk together about it. It broke the cycle. Because as long as secrets and family skeletons remain, you have to ask the question, who and what's being protected? And so this is at the heart of why the Truth and Reconciliation Commission can work so well. Because we're finally saying, let's bring out the skeletons. Let's bring out the secrets. Let's bring out the trauma in a way that can be received, honoring, respectfully, what took place. So I love the wisdom of the two authors. But before I get into walking through together what their advice is and their wisdom, I'd like to remind us that there's a real danger of focusing on the simple story without responding or respecting to the multiplicity and complexity of the overlapping stories. Okay? So there is a part in our culture where, oh, just tell your story, just tell your story. So we see this on TV shows. We certainly see this online. We see this texting. I mean, my nieces are saying stuff in their social networking that are just embarrassing for themselves. So much so, their parents are saying, don't listen to Jennifer. Even though they know that what they put out there can stay there forever, they still put it out. So to simplistically think, if I just tell this little part of the story, it's going to remain the same forever. No, it won't. Aren't you embarrassed about some of the things you said and did when you were 10 years of age? Or 15? Or 21? Or last week? But to naively think that if I just tell this little story without respecting how it fits in the whole family story, or the story of our time, our culture, our faith, it can do serious damage. Why? Because stories that we learn from the sacred scriptures of any religion are a means. They are creative expressions of the mysteries. The mystery of being human, the mystery of God, the mystery of relationship, the mystery of the cosmos. And so to tell them ruthlessly without respect or honor for the larger picture does a real disservice, not only to the story, but to the particular group that we're involved in. So, The two authors point out to us that the first thing we need to do is to start with the facts. What are the facts of the situation to the best of our ability? And to speak the truth of those facts. Always remembering that your perspective is your perspective. As Father Richard Rohr likes to say, a viewpoint is always just a view from a single point. Ask any police officer who comes to interview the witnesses to a crime or to a traffic accident. There's always different stories. Okay? Those of you who have ever served in a jury, you know this to be true. And those of us who have done marriage counseling, we know there's at least two sides of the story. I've discovered there's more than two sides of the story. There's a complexity that needs to be honored. When we speak about start with the facts, we need to humbly recognize this is how I experience them, through the lens of my experience, or the lens of my training, or the lens of this particular time in my life. After that, we want to ask the question, well, how will these facts be expressed? How can you express these facts? How can you find your own voice? How can you find your own voice? And each of us, in our own creative ways, are invited to find our voice to express what's inside so that it can liberate not only ourselves, but others. I learned a wonderful one-liner that's been very helpful in my life. Maybe it'll be helpful for you. And that is, impression without expression leads to depression. Impression without expression leads to depression. In other words, something's been impressed upon you. And if you deny it or say, oh, it's not that important, or that's not true, without allowing an equally emotive response in a viable, expressive manner, then eventually you'll end up depressed. Because it means you're denying the truth of what's taken place, or the reality of what's taken place. So the reason Desmond, I believe, has taken a whole chapter talking about telling a story is because the way we tell the story can continue to imprison us, or it can be told creatively as a way of engaging the meaning significance of the story. Or it could be told as a therapeutic means of healing and reconciliation. I believe, for example, that one of the reasons that we are an addictive compulsive society is that we're not willing to use ritual in its correct place. And so it comes down to ritualizing repetitive patterns of behavior. Because behind every human behavior is a need waiting to be expressed. And very often, the human behavior is expressed at the wrong level or in the wrong way. It's not liberating. It locks us up. So here are some different categories. And maybe as I give you this collage, it might help you individually, or help you in your relationships or in your own careers or ministries. First one is in the realm of the written form. You could tell your story through journal entries, through the writing of poetry, through writing a fantasy. This is often done with children. Tell me a story about when you were a little boy, a little girl. And let it be a story about, and give them a theme, knowing that's the theme of the trauma that they need to talk about. Or the telling of dreams, writing down of dreams, and honoring that. Most recently, I've noticed coming into my office, a lot more people struggling and being embarrassed by daydreams. Okay? Daydreams can be just as powerful as honoring what's trying to wake you up and writing those down and noticing the pattern. Okay? If written form is not helpful for you, how about the expressive form? What types of play do you like to do? Or if you say, oh, I'm too old to play, go back to when you're about 4 to 7 years of age and look at the theme of how you play. Is that theme, emotion, playfulness still in your life today? Because that's a part of who you are. Another angle would be dance. My mom loved to dance, and her life was really opened up when her confessor told her, for your penance, Trudy, I want you to dance for 15 to 20 minutes. She said, that's not a penance, that's fun. He said, that's why I'm asking you to do it, because I want you to see that God wants you to delight in your life. Music, whether written, played, listen to, art. And if you say, for example, oh, I'm not artistic, well, then you're saying that God didn't do a good job with you. Okay? We all are artistic in different ways. It's about finding the expression that flows easiest for you. Okay? Another area is sand tray. I've done this a few times. It's very liberating. Where you choose different figures and you have like a parameter. Victor Turner loves this stuff because it's like the cosmos put before you in a circle or a square. You choose these different figures and this means that and this means that, and you create a scene. They do this again with children to help them express what's going inside in terms of how to express traumatic events. Maybe that level is not helpful for you. How about the level of therapy? That a counselor, a therapist, is a trained listener. To listen between the cracks and crevices of your story in such a way that they can help you see your story from a whole different perspective. I never thought of it that way. Well, why don't you give that some thought? Enter the story the way I've just presented you. It can be so liberating. Or the psychodynamic method, which means that you engage the body in the experience. For example, when I was a boy, there's nine men in our family and two women. My dad would come home from work, never told us why he would do this, but he'd come home from work, give my mother a kiss, kind of say hi to his kids, he'd grab a newspaper and sit down and open it up. It's like he's building a wall around himself. Now from our perspective, as kids, it was like we had spent the whole day with women. Mom, female teachers, fellow classmates, come home, we're looking for some male energy. Come on, Dad! So we'd be throwing footballs in the front room, playing catch and tackling each other. And every once in a while, we dared to take the football and throw it over the newspaper to Lana's lap. Do you think he smiled and said, well, isn't that funny, you know? No, he was like a bear coming out of the cave. It was only later when I asked him, I said, Dad, what was that all about? He said, as you know, both my parents were alcoholics. He said, if I didn't do that, I would stop at the bar on the way home. He said, I needed 20 minutes to separate between work and being with you kids. And I said, why didn't you just tell us that? We could have understood. But for us, the message was, I don't have anything to do with you. He says, that's not what I meant. We understand that now, but we didn't then. So the psychodynamic method that a therapist did with me, which is perfect, he said, sit on the floor. We were in a small group facility. And he says, now pick one of these men who, in your image, kind of represents how big your father was. And I picked this big guy, sat him in a chair, gave him a newspaper, and we went through the whole scene. Oh, God, was that liberating. It was painful, but it was liberating. Because I found my voice to open the conversation. That's what we call a psychodynamic method. How about the area of relational? Maybe you're the type of person, the best way that you can really tell your story is sit down with your best friend. Or sit down with a small group that you've been with for a long time and just begin to tell your story from beginning to end. As long as you make the agreement, no interruption, that it can be truly received in the gift and presence of the group. Remember one man who came into therapy, his first session, and he sat down and the therapist waited for the man to say something. He didn't say a word. So waited. 45 minutes of silence. With 5 minutes to go, the client said, thank you, doctor, for listening to my silence. You're the first one who's honored that part of my story. I'll be back next week to tell you the rest of it. Powerful. So silence can be a way that we tell our story. It also is the best gift sometimes we can give somebody who needs to talk it out. Can you live with my silence so that you can live with my words? And the last one is the embodied way of speaking the story. This would be, for example, many of the native peoples do this, where we go out to creation and we just sit and talk to the tree, talk to the mountain or the canyon. We talk to the leaves, or this is a favorite one of theirs, talk to the rain, because there's a similarity between the tears of the human person and the rain coming down. And just talk it out. Scream it out. I found it to be very liberating when I, as a priest, did a ritual in regards to my own traumatic reaction to the clergy abuse scandal in the world. It was horrific. And I needed to scream. Scream at the cosmos, to scream at the church, to scream at God, to get it out. Because, you know, as clergy, we're trained to be nice, not to be real. And so that was a very liberating experience for me. Another way is what we call shadow work, where you engage the unexpressed, unacknowledged, rejected parts of your humanity. And if we do that for much of our life, when we hit midlife, it's all piled up waiting for you. And this is why for many people in midlife, at least from one perspective, it's a very difficult time. Because all that unacknowledged stuff says, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. Okay? And if we still keep pushing it back, eventually it's going to come out in some sort of illness, one way or another. The last one is ritual. Ritual is a very traditional, embodied way of telling your story. So much so that for 70,000 years, human beings have been using ritual. So if I could put it this way, to tell the story authentically, it's the work of reframing it. In ritual making, it is about reenacting the new story, so that together this becomes the most traditional way of being transformed, cooperating with the Creator, making our lives new again. How sad that in our Christian tradition, we split this down the middle. And one half of Christian group, Protestants, said, we just want the story, nothing more. The other half said, all we want is the ritual. And no wonder we had such a hard time during those many hundreds of years of separation. We are slowly beginning to honor that both are important, both are necessary, not only in worship space, but in the primary space of our own human lives, that we are to find ways and means of telling our story, listening to each other's story, reenacting, ritualizing our lives in times of transition, in times of trauma and impasse. Let me tell you a story, an example of this. A woman by the name of Ellie, short for Eleanor, came from another country. And her best friend told me one day, you need to talk to her about ritual. I said, well, she's your friend. I will be happy to talk to her, but she's got to call me. I'm not going to say, hey, I'm here to help you. So she knew I was willing, but she didn't come to me for 2 years. She just wasn't ready. But then when she finally came, this was her story. She was traumatized the time she was a small girl, but this really reached its breaking point for her when she got married. They had a son. And then, I forget how many years into the marriage, her husband started having an affair. He was so ashamed and embarrassed by it, felt so guilty, that he decided the way to dump his guilt off was on his wife by saying, you're having an affair. You know, you heard that saying, the best defense is an offense? That's what he's doing. She wasn't having an affair. She didn't know anything about the affair. So she kept saying, I'm not having an affair. Because of her hours, he was accusing her that she was having an affair with her boss. And I don't know why she did this. I have no idea. But eventually, under the weight of his accusation over a period of many, many, many months, she finally confessed, thinking that he'd stop. Okay, stop, you know, haranguing her. Well, it just got worse. Well, the two of them, husband and wife, conceived another child. And he demanded an abortion because he's not my child. Well, again, she gave in to his desires and had the abortion. And because of the experience of it, what it did to her, she said, I'm done. And she left him, left the country, and came here. And she is one of the few women I've met in life where all I can say is that her face was hard. It was like granite. And just by her look, she kept people away. And the sound of her voice, it was a hard voice. You know what I mean? Hard voice, hard face. So when she told me that story, I said, yes, I said, this is perfect for ritual. Now, what I'd like you to do is let's do this in the wonderful way of the lamentation. Would you write down all that you need to lament? And here are some things that can help you. I hate that. I'm angry that. I'm sad that. Whatever it is, just keep writing until you can't write anymore. And then I'd like you to choose a particular symbol of what you want to become. And then also choose a pattern piece of cloth. And then she chose, she wanted this to take place in the basement of a church, and she chose the people that she wanted there. So we got together, and I had her place, it was a sari, by the way, He placed it on the floor. She stood over here. The rest of us stood in a semicircle. And Ellie began the lamentation like she was reading sacred scripture, because she was. The sacred scripture, the story of her life. And as she's reading it, line after line, she starts to cry, then to weep, then to sob. She finishes, and all I say is, please step on the cloth. She steps on the cloth, and it was like spontaneously her body knew what to do. She fell down and curled up into a fetal position and began to sob. Her body was racked with pain. It was all coming out. And snot was coming out all over the place, and these poor women were trying to give her some semblance of propriety. So I said, don't touch her, leave her alone. We're here to witness what's going on, nothing else. We waited. She cried for a long time, a lot of sobbing. And when she was ready, she finished, she stood up, and I motioned for her to step off the cloth. She stood there, and I picked up, she had chosen this rock with a scripture passage on it, gave it to her. I said, Ellie, what new name have you chosen? And she stopped and she said, Bernadette, because that's the name I would have chosen for my daughter if she had lived. Whoa. That's when I was touched. And so I had some blessed oil and I made the sign of the cross on her forehead, and I received the gift of your new life, Bernadette, as God's beloved daughter. And then I gave the blessed oil to the man standing next to me, and then he gave it to each of the three women. Each of them blessed her. In this particular culture, Filipino culture, they all started to dance spontaneously and clap and sing and created a spontaneous song about Bernadette. I tell you this story because when it was all over, we were walking across the parking lot to our cars, and she kind of sidles up to me and says, Father Jim, I'm not sure if this is the right feeling. Isn't this funny? But I feel so happy and so peaceful. It's like bubbles inside of me. Is that the right response? And I said, yes. I said, absolutely. That's God's way of letting you know you've really honored the deep, dark, shameful secret of your life and the truth of your goodness. Now, I can publicly tell you, this woman is transformed. She doesn't have that hard look anymore. She's a beautiful-looking woman. And she has now volunteered almost full-time at her parish. I think too much. She cannot not keep giving life away. The real fruit of it isn't just that. She got the courage to go back to her country, to face her husband, just like Desmond talks about, to let him know what he did to her and that she will not put up with that ever again. Things have really changed in her life. She's a brand new woman. So let's look at the second part of his wisdom, and that is, who do you tell the story to? Obviously, it helps to kind of test it. Somebody who's trusted. In the Catholic tradition, this is why we choose spiritual directors or confessors. Today, we might also include soul companions or mentors. But to kind of test the waters, to put it out there. The thing I think that is so important is what Tutu points out, and that is that our stories evolve as our understanding evolves, as our acceptance evolves, and as our meaning-making evolves. I know of a woman who also had a terrible, tragic childhood. Her father was killed by his best friend. He was knifed to death at 3 years of age. She, thankfully, didn't witness it, but she lost her father early in life. Her mother was, I believe she was 17 or 18, didn't feel like she could handle her daughter alone, so she sent her away to boarding school. Can you imagine that? 5 years of age, she went to boarding school. And she stayed there through high school. So her whole sense of mothering and being mothered went out the window. Okay. Then, as part of her desire, because she didn't know how to cope with all this, she found herself being attracted to other women. Okay. She got immersed in the gay lifestyle. Her family disowned her. Her partner was an older woman who was very, very maternal, and they truly loved each other. As her story began to unfold, she reached a point where she realized that she outgrew her partner. Which even then, she was rather confused. And so she began to date other men. But interestingly enough, she dated men who were not, shall we say, appropriate for her. She got involved with married men. She got involved with men who were abusive, et cetera, et cetera. So you kind of get the picture. Here is a woman now who is really emotionally mixed up. And she finally told, she has married a wonderful man. They're happily married. Just celebrated 25 years. But she finally decided to tell somebody else besides her husband her story. And she chose me. And as I listened, I said, well, that makes perfect sense. She said, what are you talking about? As I fed back to her in just a few sentences what I heard her story was about, she started to cry. She said, you're the first person that's helped me to find meaning in my story. I always thought God was cursing me, that I was the reject, the black sheep of the family, because her mother went on to marry and kind of had two separate families, didn't want to deal with this first child. And I said, no, it makes perfect sense. I share this story with you because just last week, she told me about a situation in her community. And she handled it beautifully as a mentor. Beautifully. Because before this time, she was emotionally not only a wreck, but any time she said goodbye to somebody that was significant to her, she would just fly into a rage. But the way that she handled it was just so mature and therapeutic. It was unbelievably beautiful. Because she understands herself differently now in her 60s. She accepts herself and her story, and she's found meaning in her story. So let's say this theologically. The cross is the reminder and the symbol of not pain, suffering, sin, habitual patterns avoided, but faced and confronted and given meaning. That's what the crucifix means. And that's why we don't, we don't avoid any of this. Rather, we confront it humbly, honestly, lovingly, compassionately. And that's where the transformation comes. It's especially hard when it's our own life. But that's what this woman did. She is a different woman. Different woman. A woman of great passion and great liveliness. The third thing that the two authors point out is to tell the story directly to the perpetrator, if it's at all possible. And I really appreciate and underline Desmond's insight here as a pastor, and that is, if it's possible, don't force it. If you can't do it, writing it in a letter form can be almost as liberating. But what's difficult about this particular work is that you have no guarantees of how the perpetrator will respond to you. And this is why we are to seek to see the story from the side of our enemy, the perpetrator. To do our very best. To come to some sort of understanding. Why is this so important? And please don't throw anything at me, okay? But believe it or not, what Jesus is teaching here is that in terms of the soul, our enemies can become our best friends because they wake us up to parts of us that we don't want to look at. So this is why we do this work of forgiveness, this healing reconciliation work. We want to do our best to try and see it from the side of the perpetrator of the enemy. This goes also with your ex-spouse, with a neighbor who keeps making noise at 12 p.m. at night, you know, a co-worker who seems to stab you in the back, to recognize none of us are completely 100% innocent. It's the ego inside of us that wants to keep saying, oh, yes, I am. Yes, I had nothing to do with this. It's not my fault. But a very humbling, helpful question from the perspective of the soul is, what do I need to change? What is there about me, implicitly or explicitly, that needs to be looked at from a different perspective? So I'd like to give you an example from a program that was developed here in Ojai. I'm not sure if you've heard of the Ojai Foundation. Have any of you heard of the Ojai Foundation? Some of you have. They've developed this upon their study of many, they would say, most cultures in their native expressions, as well as most religions, have what they're calling the way of counsel. The way of counsel, very simply, is getting a group of people seated in a circle so that everybody can see each other's eyes. And then there's a sacred object that's used. Who's ever speaking would hold the object, okay? And then everybody else listens. There's no interruption, okay? Only the person holding the sacred object speaks. In a sacred space, typically it's something like a candle or a gong or a shell or different images or symbols from each member on the council, okay? And you can reach in and take one and dedicate that particular time of sharing to a group outside the circle. So, for example, if it's a group of women who've been domestically abused, maybe one woman would take an image and say, I'd like to remember all the other women who aren't in the circle, but who are with us in spirit as we talk about our pain. Okay? So that's the way I counsel. Anyways, there's a very powerful story told about prison in Salinas, in Soledad, called the Salinas Valley Prison. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but it's one of the most violent prisons in the entire country. This particular leader from the Ojai Foundation did was he had made a friendship with the warden, and the warden invited him to come and to experiment with the prisoners with the way of counsel. So they set it up. It's amazing as they have this video demonstrating how this works. Here are these very hardened criminals, all different backgrounds, different crimes, different races and cultures. And what they're doing is they're learning tools of how to tell their story and to find meaning for their transformation. They are learning, perhaps for the first time in their life, to open their heart and to trust other human beings. So, for example, the leader or facilitator of the group would start with a prompt. I'm wondering what you're thinking about right now, or what's stirring in your heart right now. Okay? So that's the prompt. And then the facilitator would start and say, well, what's stirring in my heart is just this gratitude to be here with you men, and to really honor your courage and trust to share your painful story. That's what's stirring in my heart. Then he'll put talking piece down. Another man in the group will pick it up when he's ready, and he'll start speaking. And just by listening to the truth of the story, these men begin to become brothers in the real sense of the word. Do you know that there's a waiting list for the men to do this? Because the facilitators can't come every day. There's a waiting list. These hardened men, word gets out throughout the prison, they want to be involved. They interviewed the warden, and he says, yes, things are definitely different for the men who participate in this. They have a whole different aura that's different. Last point. The fourth thing is that we are to accept whatever happened cannot be changed, nor undone. That, my friends, very simply, is what Christ asks us to do. We can't change the past. We can live in the present differently. How might we do that? Well, there's some very simple practical ways. One is to practice healing of memories. Very simply is, whatever trauma or event you've gone through, is to close your eyes and picture that scene again. It might be helpful to have somebody that you trust or love there with you, if you like. But picture that scene again, but this time, picture Christ there. If you're not Christian, you might want to picture a very consoling light or abiding presence. Excuse me. And then go through the scene again, but this time, notice how Christ or the light responds to you and what takes place to you. What God does, in God's creative, wonderful love, God doesn't take the memory away from you. God helps you put the memory in a context that can be liberating and healing for you. Another way, very simply, is just practice breathing. Really breathing. Breathe in, hold the pain, acknowledge it. My body hurts. All I want to do is just cry. Just hold it, acknowledge it. And when you're ready, let it go. You might need to do that several times, back and forth. You're instructing your body. We're working together now. It's time to let it go. Okay? Third way is to do it with your fists. Okay? When you're angry, acknowledge it. When you're hurt, acknowledge it. Tighten your fists. Tighten your whole body. Then unclench it. And unclench it just as slowly as you possibly can. Don't go further than you feel like your body's inviting you to do it. And the last way that I find very helpful is use an object. Okay? An object that you can bury, an object you can burn, an object that you can throw. One time I was dealing with some issues around my mother, and I decided to go to the ocean. I picked up this huge boulder. It was huge. But I remember I consciously decided I need to carry this and feel it in my body. So I carried it about 100 yards. And finally I said, I'm tired of doing this. All of this was a part of what I was trying to express. I'm tired of carrying this all life long. And I probably shouldn't have done this. But I lifted it up about this high. And I said, okay, God, I'm done. This is yours. And with all my effort, I threw it in the ocean. And then I just watched the waves just kind of lap up against it. And I could feel my body saying, yeah, we're done together. And I walked away. There was a transformative letting go in that experience. What might work for you? So I invite you during the break to talk about it with each other, to reflect on it, to acknowledge that we're all in this together, that nobody has a perfect answer, but the co-authors here have given us some good beginnings. So we'll talk some more after the break.